back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode number 700 of Back to the Bins. Today is a very special episode, and we decided to treat it as very special by acting as if nothing's going on. Of course, you know, you have to do something, so we brought along Ryan Daly with us today because he just screams anniversary episode.
Entertain us.
I couldn't be more special. Thank you for having me. I'm honored.
So Ryan is here, obviously, and I'm here, as always, with my good friend David Pascarella. And just to pull the curtain back a little bit, for episode 700, the original plan was Dave had suggested we invert the numbers and we do an episode on James Bond, 007, which Dave and I have actually recorded already, but it is not at episode 700. It'll be coming up shortly, but it is just an episode that we did with two James Bond books. Then Scott suggested that we do the 700 Club and do actually like religious books, which we were going to do. But what ended up happening is the timing of this all worked out that episode 700 was coming up right around the time of Christmas, and we decided, you know what? We'll do our Christmas episode. It's kind of the 700 Club. It's good enough. But just to reminisce a little bit really quickly before we get into the books that we've picked, 700 episodes, as I said to Dave the last time we talked about this, I never thought I'd be doing this long enough to hit episode 700. I was not there when the series started. I didn't come on until episode 80-something. But when you factor in the Avengers spotlights we did that were not numbered, plus some extra numbers, I'm probably here for about 700 episodes. And Gene Hendricks could tell you the exact number of episodes that I've been here for. But I thought, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and, you know, then I'll have had enough of this. And here we are, I think 13 years later, and I'm still doing it. So
have you gotten a raise?
People.
You're the
Claremont. I have not gotten a raise in all that time. What's that?
You're the Claremont of Back to the Bins. You weren't there at the beginning, so, yeah. But once you were there, you made it special and you lasted more than a decade.
I put my stamp on it and then I just turned into the miserable person who hated everybody who came after me. So
don't hold.
That's just the way I am.
Really for you.
So this episode will actually be posted, I believe, on December 27th. So Christmas is in our rearview mirror as you're listening to this, but I hope you all had a Merry Christmas.
If you're listening, we made it.
There you go. But, you know, we all picked Christmas issues, and I say let's get at it. So, and this is just to keep going with the interesting thing, when we were talking about doing religious books, Dave and Scott both picked, you know, devout books, books that people who really were interested in religion would go for. Whereas I picked the same book that I'm going for tonight.
That was the instructions we were given.
I am altering the deal. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Well, I disregarded the instructions and I picked an issue that had a religious theme because I picked Marvel 2-in-1 number 8, which recreates the Nativity. I thought that's a religious thing. But, you know, I think Scott thought I was pretty much insane when I said that was the book I was going to do. Anyway, I'm still going for it because it kind of goes with the Christmas theme anyway.
And you had
anyway,
it read.
Marvel 2-in-1. And I had it read. How much do you expect me to read? I'm not that smart. So Marvel 2-in-1 number 8 was released on December 10th of 1974. The cover date is March of 1975. It is written by Steve Gerber, who right off the bat, I always find Steve Gerber's books to be outrageously weird and fun. It's penciled by Sal Buscema, inked by Mike Esposito, colored by George Rosos, lettered by Charlotte Jeter, and edited by Len Wein. The cover by Gil Kane shows the Ghost Rider riding with the thing kind of like tagging along on the back of his motorcycle, and, you know, with his feet up in the air because I guess the motorcycle is going so fast, and they're coming down on what looked to be the wise men. And it says Silent Night, Deadly Night. The synopsis is that Ghost Rider, biking across the Arizona desert on Christmas Eve, nearly collides with three men who seem to be the three wise men of biblical fame, and goes on to find a near-perfect recreation of the first Christmas. In New York, Mr. Fantastic is observing a strange new star. He determines the location to which the star is pointing, the Conahodee Indian Reservation in Arizona. To prevent Reed from missing his family Christmas party, the Thing insists on being the one to investigate it. Meanwhile, Ghost Rider gets closer to the recreation of biblical Bethlehem and finds the Joseph and Mary of the act. It turns out that all present in the town are members of the Kiwazi native tribe. Ghost Rider is then attacked by the Miracle Man, who hurdles him out of town in a tornado. When the Thing arrives, Ghost Rider agrees to accept his help, and the two sneak back into the city disguised as two of the three wise men. There they confront the Miracle Man, who reveals to Ben that he conjured up this reenactment as part of a plot for revenge.
Revenge!
Revenge!
Now we're cooking, huh?
Against the tribe and the Fantastic Four for his previous defeat at their hands. After a battle against Ghost Rider and the Thing, the Miracle Man is knocked out. Suddenly, the ancient Native Americans that gave Miracle Man his new powers appear and take him away, reversing all the damage he had done. Afterwards, Ghost Rider departs, feeling a little better after the whole experience. Now, I am probably the only one of the three of us who bought this off the stand when it came out. And I was reading them regularly at this point. I may be one of only two of us who were alive when this came out.
What year did this come out? Like
1954.
Oh, okay.
I'm thinking Ryan didn't exist at that point.
Not yet.
I was here.
The prophecies were there about me, but I wasn't existent at that time.
It's funny because around this time, it's, you know, around the same time as when I first started collecting comics, and I was getting some back issues, and Miracle Man first appeared in Fantastic Four number four. Number three. And then he didn't appear again until 130-something. And around that time, I had gotten those back issues when I first started collecting. So I read those issues, the 130 issues, not number three. And I thought they were pretty cool. I thought he was a cool villain. I was pretty good with it. And then this came out not that long after that. And since then, I've heard that everybody hates Miracle Man. They thought he was like a real mort of a villain and that he should never have existed ever. But I thought this was cool. I liked the story. I'm kind of cool with it. My biggest thing as I was rereading it is when they dress as the wise men, how does the Ghost Rider put a kind of a whatever you call the thing they have on their head over his flaming head without it bursting into flames?
It's fire retardant.
Yeah, apparently. You just see smoke coming out from under it.
I don't know, but he looks like a Lich King with that outfit. Like, he should be on the side of a van.
But, you know, I thought this was pretty cool. And, it, you know, I like the fact that they were, you know, I thought coming out at around Christmas time, it was pretty cool to be doing the recreation of it. The plot that Miracle Man has, like, where he thinks this is going to lead to his revenge, I'm not really sure how that was going to work, but I was still kind of cool with it. I liked, you know, the Christmas issues for this stuff, and I liked Steve Gerber's stuff. His stuff was always wacky, and I look back to around 75 or so when we went to a Manhattan comic show, and Steve Gerber was there, and it was before, you know, it was before the days of New York Comic Con when there were a billion people there. It was much more laid back, and I remember us talking to Steve Gerber, and we were, you know, in our early teens at the time, and we didn't really get his sense of humor, you know, at that point. We weren't quite sophisticated enough to get it, but I thought he was actually really cool to us, despite the fact that we were, you know, like punk kids that didn't really get it. I've always had a soft spot for Gerber's stuff, and some of it is just batshit crazy. This isn't as far gone as a lot of the other stuff he did.
I couldn't imagine where this was going, to be with you.
My story or the book?
Either one. I was a little confused with both of them, but it was a fun ride to get there.
Yeah, there you go. Had you read this before, or was this a new one for you?
For me, they're almost all new, the Marvel ones.
You're too much of a DC acolyte. Even being the Marvel zombie that I am, I think I've read more DC stuff than you've read Marvel stuff.
Undoubtedly true. How about you, Ryan?
Yeah, I read this a couple of Christmases ago because Siskoid and I covered this one on an episode of FW Team Up that we did. So I was familiar with this, and really, as soon as you recommended it, I was eager to jump back into it because I like this one a lot. And I'm repeating some of the same things I said in that episode, but I like Ghost Rider a lot. I've also read a lot of mediocre and unimpressive Ghost Rider comics. But just, he's one of those characters that is going to get a pass and a little bit of leeway just because of the visual. It's a flaming skull on a motorcycle. It's like, dude, like, yeah, I may be simple in a lot of ways, and that's one of those things where it's just the part of me that never grew up just thinks that's really, really cool, so I want to read about that. And then to put that in a story with, like, overt Judeo-Christian themes, it, just like the sort of reversal of that with a co-star who is Jewish, although I don't know that Ben Grimm...
I don't think that had been determined at that point.
Yeah, probably not at this time. But I always had a fun time with the story. It's having neither to do with Ghost Rider or The Thing. In the brief little scene that we get with Reed, it kind of demonstrates why he is one of, if not my favorite Marvel character, even though I find it very hard to defend him a lot of times. And it's because for all of his brilliance, and I do think he is incredibly thoughtful and clueless at the same time. Because he presents his wife and his family with what he thinks is an awesome Christmas present, this tree with lights and everything like that. And he thinks the present is enough. He doesn't have to be there. But it's like, you know, you'll enjoy this. You have this in place of me. Why do you need me? And he doesn't get that. It's like, no, the experience of having your husband and father with you is the thing. That is the present. That's what they care most about. And he doesn't think that way. So I just kind of like that a little bit.
He could have. But
yeah, this is also a very, very Steve Gerber story.
The whole Reed thing. Now, you know, I've talked recently about how I don't necessarily like my heroes to have feet of clay, but that really comes down to their motivation, not their actions as much. Like, I don't want them to do things that are evil or selfish or greedy. I want them to be above all of that. But to be a little thoughtless or bubble-headed, you know, kind of like that he's so focused on one thing that he does things wrong with the other stuff, I'm kind of cool with that. I think that makes him a three-dimensional character.
I think the 80s and 90s kind of changed the way we think about the anti-hero as a concept and much more of the person with good intentions or maybe just the person who fights evil, regardless of his intentions, but has a lot of, demons on the side. Whereas I think, as opposed to the DC heroes of the Golden and the Silver Age, when Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko and those guys kind of birthed the Marvel Universe as we know it, they were creating anti-heroes in the sense that these are people that you would not necessarily assume are the prime candidates to get these superpowers. If you were going to give somebody the proportionate powers of a spider and all that strength and ability, is the first person you would give it to a 15-year-old science geek? Maybe not. If you were going to give somebody a $1 billion suit of armor that can wage war on an entire country by itself, You're going to give it to a womanizing alcoholic? Probably not the first choice. The Incredible Hulk is a...
Well, he wasn't an alcoholic back then. Let's be fair. Yeah. He wasn't an alcoholic back then.
Fair enough. But he had other issues. And like Dr. Strange, I mean, so much of their origins were about them being incredibly flawed people and having to overcome those flaws.
But I think the flaws were not in their motivation.
No.
In fact, that's the key to Peter mm-hmm. Parker's origin as Spider-Man, that, you know, he learned with great power comes great responsibility. And he knew, you know, from that point forward that he had to dedicate his powers to do the right thing and to take care of things. You know, even though it was, you know, remade in whatever it was, 2008 in the movie, the origin of Iron Man is pretty true to what we originally got in Tales mm-hmm. of Suspense. And he was somebody who worked for a munitions company and kind of learned the error of his ways as far as warmongering and things like that. So, yeah, they were flawed people, but their ultimate humanity was what guided them. And they all had, you know, especially back then, they all had a strong moral compass. And that's right. All I need. I'm good with flaws, but I want them to have a strong moral compass. In fact, I don't necessarily want them to be flawless at all. And that's one of the things we've talked about so many times, Dave and I and Scott and I, just, you know, that when they make Batman, you know, that he's so invincible, you know, I want him to be a little bit of flawed. I want him to make a mistake now and again, but I want his motivations to be right.
Right. Yeah. The distinction where I was drawn would be like the DC heroes, the Silver Age heroes. If Barry Allen was never struck by that bolt of lightning, he would still be a police forensic scientist working to put criminals away. And he was really good. If Hal Jordan never got the ring, he would still be a daredevil test pilot. Clark Kent would still be a crusading journalist fighting for truth, justice in the American way. And Bruce Wayne would still be the smartest, richest, most, you know, however, whatever things that he was drawn to do. But so they were, the DC heroes were already kind of superior, noble people before they got their powers. Whereas I think part of the origin of the Marvel characters is them getting their powers could be an impetus that turns them into a life of service and honor. That's the way it was with Peter Parker, who initially was thinking about using his powers for selfish reasons. And Tony Stark was just thinking about money. And Stephen Strange was just obsessed with medicine before he got all these powers that sort of turned them into more altruistic and virtuous people. They may have not been, they weren't necessarily evil, but they might have had more egocentric ideas.
Nobody in the DC universe was concerned about making ends meet.
Right?
That is very true. And, yeah, I mean, there is, you know, this is something, obviously, you could dedicate several shows to this, but the maturation of comic books over the years and how, you know, the original paradigm of what made a hero back in the Golden Age and how that developed into the flawed heroes of the Silver Age and the Bronze Age for that matter. But then, you know, as the Bronze Age progressed, and then we got the anti-heroes. And I think there is a point probably in the 2000s, early 2000s, where I think they went a little too far with some of the anti-heroes, where, you know, they were not people who I would want to root for. And I do want my comic book heroes to be people I want to root for. So
keep in mind, they changed from the beginning, too. You know, if you read the really early Superman and Batman, they're really like vigilantes. The police are trying to get them and that kind of stuff. Then the war comes along and they become, you know, lockstep with, you know, Uncle Sam and USA and deputized officers of the law. So already from out of the gate, they evolved.
True. I mean, I can't argue with any of that. But I do think there was still... they still were presented as very pure at heart.
Well, DC was very stagnant from, I'd say, the post-war years up until, what, the 70s?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, well, what I always said was that DC started the Silver Age, but then they got mired in the Silver Age for a long time and didn't move into the Bronze Age until way after Marvel had done so.
And I think so much of that had to do with the comics code and Marvel sort of, I mean, the way the Marvel that we think of came about 20 years, 15 years after the Comics Code Authority and everything, and DC had been in the game and had been adhering to that self-imposed, you know, restrictions, that it took them longer to break away from it because that was just, you know, they were so enmeshed in that, whereas Marvel was a little bit more rebellious out of the gate.
I read a book, a real book, you know, without pictures, about the history of the
comic. They have those things?
Yeah, believe it or not. And they were saying the whole culture at the time, like, if you worked for DC, you showed up to work, you had a college shirt, you know, and a tie on. Marvel was completely the opposite. It was a whole cultural shift.
But I think Marvel embraced the idea that that a lot of their readers were now college age, whereas DC was still thinking that their audience was, you know, 8 to 12 year olds.
Yeah,
and I think that was where Marvel went into the Bronze Age and DC kind of stayed back.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So, what do you think of the artwork in this?
I mean, I'm a big Sal Buscema fan. He's never drawn a comic that I didn't like in terms of, I didn't like the art. At the same time, like, he's not going to win a ton of art contests for me. It's hard to describe because I don't want to, like, it's very much of the time. When I think of 70s Marvel, he is one of the first styles that I think of, him and his big brother. But it's just, there is kind of like a fun dynamism to his art. You know, the fabled Sal Buscema punch that you can always tell when you look at it. I don't want to say, cause it's technical, but it's very precise. It gets the stuff done. There's not like a lot of bold or unusual compositions, but it's still pleasing. It's fun. It's solid.
I think that's a pretty fair description. And what I'd say about Sal Buscema's art, see, I'm a bigger fan of John Buscema's art than Sal's.
Oh, me too.
Because John's is a little bit more dynamic.
Sure. Yeah.
But Sal's is always, you know, I'm just thinking about, like, when they talk about sports athletes, and they say, you know, what their ceiling is and what their floor is. And I'm thinking of that on a Sal Buscema level. His floor is fairly high. He never goes below a certain area. It's always, you always know you're going to at least get a decent quality book. But his ceiling is also not, you know, it's not Neil Adams' ceiling. Right. I think to some extent, because I think he was a very good draftsman, and I think he's good at storytelling. I think he's good at pacing a story. I think his images are all fairly pleasing, and I think what limitations come on it are based upon the inker to some extent, because he is going to rely on his skills to put together a decent page, and then he's going to rely on the inker to make it even more pleasing to the eye. And I think Mike Esposito, while he is a decent inker, he's more of a follow the lines anchor. He's not going to make something more dynamic than it already is. So I think in this issue, it's kind of a prime example of middle of the road Sal Buscema. It's good. it's enjoyable, but it, there's nothing about it that really jumps out at you where you say, now that's an image that I love. And I think to some extent that is a byproduct of the inking. And I don't want to get on Mike Esposito because I think he was a fine workman-like inker, but I don't think he made things dynamic.
I like that.
I find Dave, and I don't mean this in any way as a pejorative. I think I mean it as a compliment. I think you are generally, if the artwork is clean and it tells the story well, you're a happy dude.
That's right. Don't make me have to think too hard and figure things out.
Yeah, and that's great. And I think the story fits that to a T, that particular description.
I particularly love the panel with the thing laughing at the after the tree goes haywire. I just think that's such a great shot. Like,
I mean, my formative comic book reading was in the early 90s. It was early 90s Marvel and then Image comics. So those artistic styles, the Jim Lee, the McFarlane, the Liefeld, the Will Sportacio, those styles were the ones that imprinted on me at first that made me think, I was like, this is how comics should be done. So for a long time, when I would, if I read a comic like this when I was a teenager, I would scoff at this. I would throw this away. I was like, what was this drawn 500 years ago and everything? And it took me a little while to kind of acclimate. And it's funny for all the fact, I mean, for the fact that comic book nostalgia is so much of why we do this thing, this podcasting thing. I have no nostalgia for that era of the 90s that I grew up with, the 90s Marvel and Image comics. I don't like those art styles anymore. I reject them. My favorite bulk era is 1970s Marvel, before I was born. So it is kind of, but I still kind of have to work. It's like, okay, how does this art compare to the art where like every panel was designed to look like a poster, and just having to kind of reconcile with that and wrestle with that. And more often than not, I see this, but I'm almost like, this could take a little bit more rendering. And that might factor into the comic book that I picked that we'll get to in a little while.
Well, I think the battle that we're talking about, or the comparison we're talking about, is form versus substance. I think the artists of the 1990s focused way more on form and sacrificed substance a lot of times. Whereas I think Sal Buscema is he's substance through and through. He's not really worried about wowing you with an individual image. He's worried about telling a good story and making the images look nice and clean. And I think he does a great job of that. So in the grand scheme of things, while I might like a poster image by one of the people you mentioned earlier, I do think I would enjoy, I enjoy reading books drawn by Sal Buscema much more than those books, just because I think the storytelling is so much better.
I agree.
Yep.
So before we move on to our next book, I'm just going to give this a quick rating. I'm going to say the cover. I love me some Gil Kane. I always have. I always will. I changed that. When I was younger, sometimes I didn't appreciate him the way I did as I got older. I think some of the images were a little bit more rough than I wanted. But I have grown to truly love almost everything I see by him. I think this cover is dynamic. I think it shows a great image of, you know, just looking at the thing's face, the expressions on everybody's face for that matter, the action that we're seeing. I think the coloring of it kind of makes it pop as well. So I'm going to say an A- on the cover. It's not perfect, but I really like it. The interior art, I think the penciling is very, very good. I do think the inking could be stronger to make it pop more, but overall I'd say it's a B-. It's a quality book. And the story, it's fun. I'm going to say a B+ on the story. And overall, I'm going to give the book a B+.
Go ahead, Ryan.
My grades are pretty much in sync with you. I thought that the cover was B+, A- range. And it's one of those things from the era. I mean, the top half of the cover is mostly blocked out and dominated by text with the Marvel Comics group banner, and then the title Marvel 2-in-1, the Marvel 2-in-1 presents The Thing, and then you have the guest character's name behind it with its own little font and description, and then the title of the essay, or the title of the comic. So the actual image, what we're presented with, is really kind of condensed into that bottom half. But man, Kane makes it look really good. It's so fun. The image of Ghost, the thing hanging from his back being dragged with his mouth open, it looks fun. It's kind of silly. It's crowded, but it doesn't look busy. There's like a lot going on there, and like every face looks interesting. And yeah, I like that cover. Now I would say A-2. The story I would also give a B+. I thought that right away. I didn't mention this. My favorite part of the story actually is when the Thing and Ghost Rider meet for the first time. Like, what is the tradition superhero meetup in a comic? It's they see each other and they fight because of some miscommunication, some mistaken identity thing. The superheroes always have to fight first in the beginning. And this time, when the Thing sees a guy with a flaming skull for a head, he's like, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. Let's hear what he has to say. And I'm like, really? We're not going to fight right away? I was like, okay, it is a Christmas miracle. So I would give the story B+ and the art a B. It's kind of same. Overall, B+ for the grade. It's pretty much right on par with yours.
Yeah, I'm right there with you guys. I like the cover. I think it's a solid cover. The chaos of it all. To me, if you made a movie of this, this is like a Mel Brooks production. It's chaos, but it's fantastic chaos. I got a kick out of that, too, that they didn't have a fight when they first met up. And I got a kick out of how he kept calling him Mr. Grimm.
The other thing, like, when at the very beginning, when the Ghost Rider like encounters the three wise men on the camels, and they're like, will you come with us? And he's like, no, not really interested in that. It's like the sort of the call to adventure. And he's like, nope, I don't want anything to do with what you guys are doing, where you guys are going.
It's amazing, though, how nobody reacts to, you know, oh, look, it's a guy whose head's on fire. Oh, well, you know, you see that every day.
And that's the thing from the art that it was always hard, confusing in his own book, because I've read a lot of the early Ghost Rider things. It's like, okay, everybody assumes this is a mask or a helmet. So it's like, how exactly is it supposed to look? What is the fire? Like, is the fire hot? Is it burning? It's like a mystical hellfire. So, like, yeah, if he throws clothes over, do those clothes catch on fire? Clearly not. So it's just, yeah, because Ben assumes he's wearing a mask. And it's like, Ben, you're made of rock. This is your 9th adventure in Marvel 2-in-1. Every time you meet somebody who looks great, you just assume this guy is wearing a mask and it's not a flaming skull. I would think, you know, the chances are pretty good.
B pluses across the board from me.
All right, fair enough. So moving on with our Christmas theme, I guess we'll go in chronological order. Dave, your book came out next.
Okie doke. And I am bringing to the table Superman number 64 from way back in 1992. This issue is entitled Metropolis Mailbag, written by Dan Jurgens, artist Jackson Geis, and editor Mike Carlin. December 23rd, the snow gently falls and a bell rings out, the season that for some is a time of joy, a time of giving from the heart. High above the city flies the Man of Steel. Despite the season, Superman is full of dread. He's not off to battle the Eradicator, Intergang, or Mr. McSpitling, but rather he's on his way to the main branch of the Metropolis Post Office, located, of course, on 34th Street. Lois joins Superman in what has become an annual tradition for our hero. Similar to Santa Claus, every year the post office receives hundreds of thousands of letters from people all over the globe in every language addressed to the Man of Steel. All of them are asking for help. Some are from people seeking to enlist Superman in a get-rich-quick scheme. Be it helping to locate an undiscovered pool of oil, or advising Superman to press coal into diamonds. Others are from desperate people who have no one else to turn to. As they go through the letters, Superman comes across one from a Holocaust survivor in Chicago. The elderly woman who lost her family to the death camps has discovered that her sister is still alive and living in East Germany. She fears she does not have much time left and would like to see her sister one last time. This is a job for Superman. The joy Superman feels when he reunites the sisters makes it all worthwhile. Superman returns to continue going through the Metropolis mailbag. Unfortunately, most letters ask Superman for help in ways he just can't deliver. There's a woman who needs a heart transplant. There's a man who can't keep his family fed. There's a boy who asks Superman for help in saving his dad from a brain tumor. This last one includes a picture drawn of him, and it hits him in the heart. Though he's powerless to help, he's off to visit the boy to offer comfort and explain his limitations. Sadly, Superman arrives just as the boy's dad has passed. The boy rages at Superman, but Superman explains that though he wished he could have helped the boy's dad, there are many things he just can't do. Ultimately, Superman is able to save a life when the boy's mom agrees to donate her husband's heart. And Superman delivers it to the waiting transplant patient who had written him. When Superman arrives back at the post office, Lois has one more letter waiting for him. The Daily Planet's Christmas party for disadvantaged children is going to be lacking in gifts this year due to the paper's financial difficulties. The ask is for Superman to show up and distract the children from the lack of toys. This is another job for Superman, but he has a better idea than the ask. Superman enlists Professor Emil Hamilton to play Santa, and after a quick call to Bruce Wayne, there will be plenty of toys for the children. As the children are gathered on the roof of the Planet Building, an unnoticed, shadowy, garbed Superman covertly flies in a sleigh led by two reindeer, carrying Santa Hamilton and a load of gifts. Lois watches the scene unfold with appreciation for the man she loves. As Santa gives out the gifts, Superman makes a quick stop at home for a break and finds some mail for Clark. He finds in his mail an invitation to the wedding of Lana Lang and Pete Ross. Merry Christmas, Mr. Kent. And that is my contribution to this year's event. Thank you for joining me. Have a good night.
And to all a good night. I like Butch Geis's art. I don't know if it's well suited for this story. I think it has a dark feeling to it. It's more fitting for a war book or a ghost story or something like that. Something that's really grounded in almost a noir feeling. This story, I think, would benefit from someone like John Byrne drawing it. Now, almost every story would benefit from John Byrne drawing it, but this one in particular, what I would say is that somebody with a more light style, doesn't necessarily have to be John Byrne, I think would make this story even better than it is. And it is a good quality story. It kind of brings you the Christmas message, and shows Superman's desire to do the right thing and to do good and to bring peace to all men. And, you know, the whole Christmas feeling is here. But like I said, as much as I do like Butch Geist's art, I don't know if it's right for this story.
I think it is a more grounded and to some extent a somber story. So I like his art. What I think it could have used, and maybe you would agree with this, I think if he provided the pencils but somebody else inked it, I think that might have helped convey it a little bit, because there are some panels in some where it's over inked and it's dark, and I think it brings it down a little bit too much. So that's what I would have thought. Maybe just a different inker might have lightened it up a little bit.
Yeah, I think the darkness highlights the darkness highlights the somberness of the story, in that despite his best efforts, there are things that are going to continue to go on, despite the joyfulness and festiveness of the holiday.
Maybe the story would benefit from kind of a combination of what we're talking about. If the, you know, as they were going into the dark stories, the problems the people had, those things were drawn in a more dark and dreary way. And then as he influenced what was going on and helped things, you know, those panels would get just kind of progressively brighter, as they went along. That might really kind of carry the message across too. So yeah. I think I would like that.
And I happen to enjoy somber and sad Christmas stories. Like, my favorite Christmas songs tend to be the more sad and bleak ones. So
I think there was a Daily Christmas podcast that recently was posted that I have not had a chance to listen to yet. So
just a few days ago.
I'm going to have to listen to see what songs you and your brother highlight for us. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but I mean, the story is quality. I really do think the message that it brings across and everything there's a lot to be said for it, because it does give the right message for a Christmas story, and it's not just whimsical. It's bringing, you know, the reality of things, which, you know, you're pointing to, Dave, and I appreciate that. So overall, I like this book. I just, like I said, as I was reading it, I was just feeling that the artwork didn't totally fit the story to my liking.
I got a kick out of how some of the schemes and things that were mentioned kind of were callbacks to things in the past we've seen Superman do, like pressing the coal into the diamond in Superman 3, I think it was. I think there's an issue.
And in the Adventures of Superman.
Right.
In the Adventures of Superman, he does it. That's where George. I always remembered it.
Yeah. There's also, I think there was an issue in the 70s where he does perform brain surgery on somebody. my twisted sense of humor, you know, I thought of right away, this woman got to skip the transplant list, go right to the top of the list with all those other folks waiting.
It's all about who you know.
It's all about who you know.
Yeah. I liked Lois Lane's denim shorts on a snowy Christmas Eve.
In the snow, right?
Yeah. No, I like the story, and I actually hadn't read this one before. This was my first time reading. This is an era of the Superman comics that has been on my to read list for 15 years. I know this is an era that I've always wanted to get to. So this was my first time reading this particular story, and I liked it a lot, because this highlights what I think is Superman's true vulnerability, which is he doesn't want to let anybody down. And when they're asking for genuine miracles and to cheat death and to do like things that like are beyond his power, it crushes him in a way that kryptonite doesn't. And I just think, like, to showcase that it can be very powerful and very poignant. And when he has to say, like, I didn't get your letter in time, and even if I did, I couldn't have saved your dad. I'm sorry. Like, it's such a painful admission to this child as well as to himself. But because he is Superman, he's also like, you know what? I can save somebody else's life because your husband died, and he could be an organ donor transplant, and Superman just happened to have read the note to be able to pass that on. The one thing that I was a little bit surprised by, like, the structure. I would have thought that's how the story would have ended, with the organ donor transplant. But we get to that, and it's like, oh, that's page 14. We still got a whole lot to go. And then there's the whole thing with the kids, which was, well, it was nice and fun. They actually crammed a couple of good little vignettes in the story, which was nice.
And what a hero, you know, the wife was too, who's mm-hmm. just lost a husband. She could have turned around and said, well, you know, he wasn't an organ donor. Bye-bye. And there was, of course, the callback for me to Miracle on 34th Street with the whole concept of the mail being delivered to the courthouse.
Yeah.
Can I ask, what did you guys think about Bruce Wayne's dialogue?
I don't know exactly what was going on in the Batman comics at that time, and I wonder if it was tied into that. Do you know what I mean? He seemed very, I don't know, off, even for Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, it was oddly formal and just oddly, like, yeah, it just, I didn't hear Bruce Wayne's voice reading though. Like, even he only had like two or three lines, but it just seemed kind of weirdly formal and kind of like not like he's talking, like, even if he's not talking to his best friend, I think Bruce would be a little bit more relaxed and casual in the way he talks to people on the phone. But
I don't think Bruce is ever relaxed and casual.
Yeah, because Batman is known for being so chill.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the Christmas stories that we did a few years back, and it was a Batman one, and I seem to remember it was, you know, him doing all these things on Christmas Day and then capping the day off singing carols with, like, the police department or something.
Oh, yeah.
It's like 70s Batman, right?
Yeah,
yes. Yes, I think it may have been a Neil Adams drawn issue, yep. Even.
Yeah, that was a Neil Adams Christmas one.
So,
and again, that was out of the time, as we've said before, where, you know, Batman didn't have one voice. One issue he was like, oh, yes, sir, Commissioner, it's an honor, yes, sir. And the next, what, are you an idiot? You don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, the difference between a Denny O'Neill Batman story and a David V. Reed Batman story, pretty different character.
You want to rate this, Dave?
Sure. I like this cover, and I'm going to tell you, and let me tell you why.
Please tell us why.
For me, the darkness in this cover works. And this is going to sound sick and crazy, but hey, I've said a lot of crazy things on this program. The darkness in the background with the letter there, you know what it almost reminds me of? It reminds me of the trailer, if you've ever seen it, for the movie Saving Private Ryan, where they have the words of the telegram going across the screen as the voice is reading it. I just feel that's a very impactful way of getting the message across of the seriousness of the situation, contrasted with the brightness of the tree and the ornaments. I just think it's a powerful combination. I like the inside art. I think it works for this issue, but I do see a point that it's a little too dark in areas, and I really like Paul's suggestion that it should have progressively gotten brighter. And the story, I think, is out of the park. I think it's a home run. So my letter grades for the cover, I'm giving it an A-. For the interior art, I'm going to give it a B+. And for the story, it's an A+ for me. I love this story.
Okay. I like your points about the cover, and I think they are well taken. I think we balance the darkness of the shadowing and all of that with the Christmas balls and tree. So I think it sets the right tone for what we're going to get inside, and I think it's pretty good quality. So I'm going to say a solid B on the cover. The interior art, I don't think it's badly drawn, but I do think conceptually, I originally my thought was I wanted a brighter, cleaner artist to do it. But I actually, as we were talking it through, I actually like the idea of it getting progressively brighter and cleaner as it went along. I think that would be far superior to what I was first thinking. So it really is not a matter of disliking the artwork as much as just thinking the artwork could have been better suited in the way it was presented. So I'm going to say a B minus on the art. I think, you know, it's quality, but I think it could have been, there could have been a little bit more for me. And the story, I think you're right, Dave. I think this is a really high quality story. I'm going to say an A on the story. Overall, I'm going to give the book a B plus.
I'm pretty much in line with Dave. I really, really like the cover a lot. And I think the more you look in, it kind of like pulls you in and reveals more information from like the outer border with the ornaments and the holly. And it's like, okay, it's a Christmas story. We're setting that up. But why is Superman in such shadow in a Christmas story? Oh, this must be a kind of dark and bleak Christmas story. Well, what's going on? Oh, there's a lot of text. Am I supposed to read this whole thing? Well, it's cursive. Oh, it's handwriting. Oh, it's a letter to Superman, kind of like a letter to Santa. All right, what is the letter saying? Oh, it's from a kid? Oh, he's asking for his father? Oh, that's why Superman is upset. Oh, can Superman really save this kid? Like, there's so much information that kind of reveals itself a little bit at a time the more you zoom into this cover. And I do think it is a really, really powerful and really engrossing cover. So, that said, I gave it an A minus. I think I talked it up a little bit more.
A minus is a high quality grade. It's just because there's this thought that there's a minus attached to it, so that makes it bad. I mean, it's almost as high as you can get. And I'm just thinking, you know, as you're describing it, you know, you get a somebody born in more recent times, and they'll be like, oh yeah, that's a pretty cool cover. Oh wait a minute, it's in cursive. I never learned that in school, so I can't read it.
There you go. Why isn't it in text speak? LOL. Well, the interior art, I liked it more than Paul. I gave that a B plus. And the story, I gave an A because everything that you guys were saying, I really enjoyed this one a lot. At the end when Superman is carrying the sleigh and he's cosplaying as the Shadow Thief. I thought that was an interesting touch.
I thought that was actually the best drawn panel in the book too. That poster image of him carrying the sleigh. So that's it for two of our books, but we have one more, and an interesting choice it is. Because Ryan, why don't you tell us more about your choice? It's my very special friend.
We're going back to the halcyon days of the 90s that I described. Talking about Generation X issue 4. This one was written by Scott Lobdell and drawn by Chris Boccolo. Banshee and four teenage mutants, Jubilee, Monet, Sink, and Skin, are driving back to the Massachusetts campus of the Xavier Institute when a police cordon alerts them to trouble in the town of Faybrook, Maine. A young mutant named Elliot has taken a classroom full of kids hostage. He demands an education, just like every other kid, but the school board barred him from attending. The cops are all too eager to shoot Elliot, so Banshee and Generation X stealthily subdue the SWAT team while Jubilee sneaks into the school. Sink tries to use his power to get a sense of Elliot's abilities, but he can't find any mutant aura coming from the boy. Instead, he feels the presence of a mutant named Orphan Maker, who has come to kill Elliot's parents. Meanwhile, Jubilee enters the classroom to stop Elliot, but finds the boy cradling the lifeless body of his would-be teacher, Mr. Lorenzano, who suffered a fatal heart attack during the standoff. Outside, Generation X throws down with the Orphan Maker, eventually forcing him to retreat. In the aftermath, Sync confirms what his powers told him. Elliot wasn't a mutant like them. He was just born with a physical deformity that made him an outcast, hated and feared by society, which, in the end, makes him just like a mutant. So I picked this one. Again, this was formative for me because of the era when I got into the books, and the X-Men was my gateway into the larger Marvel universe. But I was a little bit too late for the New Mutants. They were just becoming X-Force when I started reading, so they were kind of grown up. So this was the first book really about the teenage mutants, the young mutants, and it was called Generation X, like a little bit on the nose, but that made me feel like it was relevant, and the kids had a little bit more of an attitude, and the art was a lot quirkier. So I really liked this book from the start, and this one being a Christmas book that came out in December, and I mean, the story just, it grabbed me, and I think the whole, without dwelling on any of the contemporary political connections that this book has, I do think this is very prescient in a way, and you can see a lot of the connections and a lot of what the themes and the ideas that this book is talking about, how they still exist in our world today. But yeah, like one of the things that just, it really struck me, and I've remembered this for the last 30 years or so, is just like Banshee's line at the very end when the kids say that he wasn't even a mutant, and Banshee's just like, he was, because he's just another kid who fell between the cracks, and that makes him like us. So
I think it's a very powerful story, and I think the more times you would read this, the more you would get out of it, to be honest with you. I think it, you know, just when I, the lesson of judging a book by its cover. When I turned to the first page of the story and I saw the figure with the gun, my initial reaction was, oh, this has to be the bad guy that they're going to take out. And then I turned the page and I see this is the police. It's like the roles are reversed. Very powerful, this story. And I'm not familiar with the X-Men. You know, I read a few of the really old things, but I had never read any of these. And I found it a very powerful story.
Glad to hear that. Paul?
I agree with you that it is very powerful. I hate to sound like a broken record. I am turned off by Chris Pachalo's art. I am not a fan of his artwork at all. I feel like he is one of numerous artists that fit what I described before, putting form over substance. I don't feel that the story flows in the artwork. I think you're not that having to read dialogue is a bad thing, which it almost sounds like I'm saying, but I feel like if you don't read the dialogue, you're not going to get where this story is going. Whereas I love a book where you can kind of see it in both. You know, you can see the progression in the artwork and read it at the same time, where the dialogue is almost highlighting what the art is showing you. Here, it's like the dialogue has to explain to you what the art is showing you. And that's something I never really like. So for that reason, I felt like this story was a little bit difficult for me to get into. And I think I had never read this one before, so... I can't say, but if we weren't doing it for the show, I don't know if I would have persevered through it. I might have seen the artwork been turned off and said, I'm not reading this one. It's just not my style. I've never been a fan of it. Generation X is definitely taking things to the next level. You know, we had the young New Mutants, but the young New Mutants, when they came out, were all very understandable and very easy to kind of relate to in their own way. And it's an interesting thing because, you know, with the mutants, it's supposed to be that, you know, that they're not relatable so much because they're outcasts, which this gives us. But Generation X, you know, with characters like Skin and Chamber and, you know, they definitely took it to a whole nother level as far as that goes. So I do really like the story, what the story is giving us, where it's bringing us. But again, the artwork really made it more difficult for me.
I was going to say I don't think you're wrong, but it's your opinion, so I couldn't say that.
By definition, I can't be wrong.
Right.
Tell him he's wrong. He's wrong about a great number of things.
Well, you can disagree. It doesn't mean I'm wrong. It doesn't mean that you're wrong. It's,
no,
well,
but,
you know,
and again,
taste is a matter of taste.
No, but I concede that I think a lot of my love for him was because of like when I kind of dove into this book and when how I became attached to him at a particular age. But like as I have gotten older, I realize I don't like Chris Bachalo that much on conventional superhero stories. I don't think his art is the best suited for that. I've seen him do he's done a lot of X-Men books and a Spider-Man run for a while, but I think he's better served on books like the quirkier books like Sandman and like some of the Vertigo titles that he was on, like the Death series. So I do think he is more of that, but because like his art made the Generation X book a little bit more quirkier and a little bit more distinct at the time, which I appreciated. And I agree, like I can see the point where just like the art necessarily doesn't tell you the story on its own, which you want that to happen. You want a comic book to be able to flow with minimal text if necessary. And I don't think this does that. However, there is a lot in the art, and it makes me look at it a little bit harder and scrutinize the panels a little bit more, sometimes to benefit, sometimes to detriment. Yeah, I work harder to appreciate the art, and maybe that's a bad thing, but I don't know. I guess if I'm predisposed to liking it, I'm going to make the extra effort. Whereas if I'm just reading something casually for fun, I don't have the same kind of investment in this, but I did.
I don't think it's a bad thing if you work harder and then you do get the appreciation based upon that working harder. I think it's a bad thing if you work harder and then you feel like, well, I really didn't get anything more out of it, but I had to work harder to get there. So, you know, it's to each their own. Obviously, you know, like you say, it's not a matter of who's right and who's wrong. It's a matter of what your tastes are.
Right. Okay, well, Dave, you vote and you be the tiebreaker. Is the art good or bad?
I'm not a fan of the art in particular.
All right,
but you know, I'm living in 1955, so don't go by me. Kurt Swan looks great, so. But you know what?
I mean, the 90s.
But the story, it works. I'm going to tell you that much. The way they draw the fella, Elliot. I mean, he's drawn, to be blunt, horribly, and what I mean. Deformed, horrible, and the tragedy is he has this disability, deformity, and because of that he's being treated even worse instead of having sympathy. Oh, you know, can we help this guy out? Let's kill him.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the tragedy is clear.
And the teacher, it's the example, you know, of no good deed goes unpunished. The one guy who was trying to somewhat help him out, he winds up he dies for his trouble.
Which I admit is a little bit out of left field and a little bit weird. Like, that's kind of, but.
All right, I guess, Ryan, your book, you want to give it some grades?
The cover, I give the cover a B+. It's an interesting stylistic cover because it's essentially like a group of little panels with our different characters with like a little description of what's going on written in almost kind of font. Like it looks like almost like a Christmas card update type of thing of what's the family doing these days. in that kind of like collage. I like the splash of colors. So I give the color a B plus. The story I give an A minus, mostly because I really, really like the overall story with Elliot and this hostage standoff and the themes of him being persecuted and denied something by the school board and by the police just because of his difference and the tragic outcome that leads to. But the other stuff, like, I mean, there are like a few little interstitial scenes that we didn't even talk about because they don't really add much. And the threat of the Orphan Maker, I don't care about. That's just something because it's a comic book and you need a fight scene. But really, that's like there are parts of this comic that, sure, I don't care about, but I like the main part so much that I gave it an A minus. And the art, conceding some of the points that we were talking about, Paul, I gave the art a B. So overall, B plus.
I looked at the cover, and you know what the image I got was in my head? Almost like the old funny papers when they used to be in the newspaper. The Sunday paper was in color. And the font reminded me somewhat of like a sword and sorcery type. But I could, you know, it's clearly Christmas related. I thought that was a neat gimmick. I also thought I'm calling it wrapping paper that's in the background is consistent throughout the whole book. And these little characters at the bottom, almost like kids looking into this world. I would give the cover a solid B plus. The interior art, it's a little, like I said, it's a very grounded, very, I know exactly what I'm looking at. So it was a little bit of a hard lift for me. And I gave it a C. But the story, I keep saying it, it's a very powerful story and it takes more than one go through. And each time you go through it, I think you pick a little more up. And for that reason, I would give the story a solid A. And I think, you know, it's not something that gets lost in time, if you know what I'm saying. You can read something from 30 years ago and go, oh my God, this is so irrelevant. Right. This is relevant today. It was relative then. If you turn the clock backwards 50, 60 years, it would have been relative back then. Right. So like I said, the story's an A. I give it overall a solid B. Okay.
Paul?
My biggest issue with the cover is I feel in my mind, and this may be purely to me individually, but in my mind, it's almost deceptive because I look at it and it almost makes me think of like one of those DC annuals where you're going to have five different stories in it. So for that reason, it like threw me off a little bit. I must feel like there should be like a triple sized issue with a bunch of stories based on the cover. I don't really get a feel for where it's going from the cover, and I personally didn't really appreciate the breakdown of where it's going. I don't feel like these characters are established enough at this point to merit a cover like this. This isn't like a Spider-Man cover where you have six different things and you say, you know, see Gwen Stacy do this, see Peter do this, see J. Jonah Jameson do that. You know, this doesn't feel like the cover that we should be getting for issue number four of a series with all new characters, or pretty much all new characters. So I'm going to give the cover a C. It didn't really grab me. It's not bad, but it didn't grab me at all. The story, I'm with you guys. I think it's very powerful, and I think the message is really strong. So I'm going to give an A to the story. I think discussing it and thinking about it, and it is one of these stories that you think about and you continually get more and more out of it, and it is like Dave said, it's going to be relevant forever in all likelihood, unless somehow, you know, we turn the world into some sort of utopia, which I'm not seeing happening anytime soon. The artwork, though, you know, and I know it's subjective, it's a matter of taste, but it's just not my art. There's a couple of images in here where I see it shining through, where I say Bracciolo had talent and he could have done it the way I wanted to. So this is really his artistic choices as opposed to his artistic ability. But either way, the final product in the paper doesn't do it for me. It's difficult to follow. It's difficult to get through. And I just wasn't happy with it. So I'm going to say a C minus on the artwork. And overall, though, because the story is so powerful, I'm going to give it a B.
More favorable than I thought you would be with the art.
Well, you know what? I have to balance my own personal tastes with my critique of the rendering. If I'm doing it my own personal tastes, the grade would drop even more. But I do see some quality in there. And if I see some quality in there, I can't just make my own tastes the total arbiter of it. I feel like I have to give credit where credit is actually due. I'm just looking at there's the image on page 16 of 24, where it's, you know, Banshee's got his hand out in front of his face, but he's like the image is really solid. And you know, there's things in here that are high quality that I have to acknowledge, but I feel like the storytelling is lacking, and I feel like the darkness of the story, I think in a different style would have worked for me. Again, you know, if we could have had more of a noir feel for it because of the messages that we're getting through here, I think it would have sat better with me. We have a lot of bright colors in here too, which kind of contrast with what we're getting. So what can I tell you? Just not my thing. As my friend sister used to say when we used to ask her to do something she didn't want to do, she'd say, "It's not my bag, man." So.
And then you got your hula hoops and your bell bottoms and you moved on.
But I appreciate you bringing it and getting me to read a book I would not have otherwise gone through, because the story and the message are really strong and powerful, and that made it all worthwhile. So I appreciate that. And I appreciate you joining us for episode number 700. And I appreciate all our listeners joining us. I appreciate everybody, and I hope everybody had a very Merry Christmas, and I wish everybody a Happy New Year.
Same here.
Joy to the
world. Thank you for coming. I hope you'll be on again soon.
You talking to Paul? I'm sure.
Thank you for coming.
No, I got to live with him all the time.
Can you just play the Odd Couple music now? Dun, dun, dun. All right. Thank you for coming on, Ryan. And again, Merry Christmas. Happy New Year to everybody. And we'll see you all next week you'll get a classic Bins episode. And the week after that, we'll be back. So bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show. And we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.